Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, bad economic news this week for Perry, Iowa, the town of about 8,000 that is just northwest of Des Moines. Arkansas-based Tyson Foods says it's permanently closing its Perry pork packing plant. And that's a move that will leave nearly 1,300 workers at the city's largest employer without jobs. Perry's mayor is getting assurances from Tyson Foods that its soon-to-be-shuttered plant won't sit empty after the company closes its doors. Mayor Dirk Cavanaugh met with Tyson officials this week, a day after the company announced its processing plant permanently closing its doors at the end of June. Let's listen to a bit of what he had to say.
Some of these people haven't been in town all that long, don't really have the resources to be without work for any amount of time, so I'm sure we're going to need some, you know, food assistance, rent assistance, those kind of things for a while till they can find another job and step up.
Now, Mayor Cavanaugh says the news came as a complete shock. Now, several organizations are stepping up to help the Latino community in Perry, who are among the 1,300 Tyson Food Plant pork employees who will lose their jobs this summer. Knock and Drop Iowa, a nonprofit organization based in Des Moines, founded when the pandemic started to help Latino families in the area access food. Now Knock and Drop is raising money to help support the employees who will be out of work come June 28th. Zuli Garcia spoke with KCCI.
We know that there's a lot of Latino families. They work in Tyson. That's their place. That's where they live. That's where they work. That's their home. We just want to make sure that we're raising enough money to be able to buy what's needed for them.
For more on the causes and implications of this closure of the pork packing plant in Perry, let's go to Lee Schultz, associate professor and extension economist at Iowa State University. Hello, Lee.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
First of all, give us some context of the factors that have led up to this closure.
Well, I think you need to really take it into a broad context when you look at how tough economic times have been for the pork industry broadly. So not just pork producers that in 2023 suffered their worst financial times ever. And that's continued into 2024, but things have gotten a bit more optimistic. But that's also the packing side. My estimates show that, you know, the packing industry has been in negative territory really since late 2021. And really the large factor being cost of production. So cost of production have increased dramatically as inflationary pressures in 2021 and 2022 have led to record high cost of production. And we haven't seen prices respond to offset those higher costs of production. And so I think a lot of that has driven ongoing structural changes that we're seeing in the pork industry.
So Lee, talk more about those costs that would affect a pork packing plant. What specific costs do you mean there?
Yeah, so when you look at a gross margin for a packer really is what they're receiving for the pork cuts, what they can get for the byproducts, and then what they're paying for hogs. As we've seen, hog prices actually took a step back last year in 2023, which led to the large negative margins for pork producers themselves. But then when you think about all the other costs of production that go into processing, and these would be both fixed costs as well as variable costs, those have all risen greatly over the last several years. And so some fixed costs examples would be depreciation of the plant and equipment, interest, insurance, property taxes. And then the variable costs, which have seen the largest increases, are labor, utilities, and shipping. And so that's really dramatically increased those costs of production for packers, which have led to those negative margins.
Tell us more about the workers that generally earn their livelihoods at these packing plants, including in Perry.
Well, and that's where I think we need to first and foremost put our attention to the impact here. When you look at meat packing, this is a highly labor-intensive, but also very trained labor-intensive business. And so when you look at the about 1,200 employees impacted, that has the direct impact of not only on those employees, but also the linkages within the economy. So there is backwards and forward linkages that really have a big multiplier effect when you have a closure to the business, because employees are earning incomes and they're spending that money in the local economy and grocery stores, Main Street business, as well as have their homes in those communities. And so when you think about the impact, it is that multiplier effect, not just the employees losing their jobs, but how it affects the whole economy.
Yeah. As I mentioned, Tyson Foods says that they won't let it sit empty, this big plant factory, after the company closes its doors at the end of June. Any idea what may happen with this plant? Perhaps Tyson do something else there?
Well, I think when you think about a facility and understanding that there is a lot of capital and technology that is in meat packing, so it creates a lot of asset specificity that make it very difficult to necessarily do something else with that facility. So, you know, I think the question becomes, you know, do they sell this facility to another business that's maybe looking to expand their footprint into Iowa or expand their larger footprint in Iowa?
Mm-hmm. What does this closure represent in our state, the bigger financial economic picture in our state? Because close to $12 billion in our state's economy, right?
Yep, and so I think, you know, it goes to that multiplier effect and goes to those linkages in the economy. And I think just to give you a little bit of context of the size of this plant, so the most recent estimates I've seen put the physical capacity of the plant at about 8,250 hogs per day. For Iowa, that represents about 5.5% of Iowa's hog slaughter capacity, and roughly it's about 1.7% of the U.S. hog slaughter capacity. So even though it's a relatively, you know, it isn't the largest of the plants out there, the largest of the plants do about 20,000 head per day. It's still a pretty good size plant and represents a pretty large size of the capacity. Now, I think when you think about impacts, you need to think about a multi-plant company like Tyson. They're going to make these plant closures are executed with company-wide capacity utilization and profits in mind. So that capacity utilization at other owned plants is part of the decision here to shut down the plant. Why I highlight that is because these hogs that were going to the Perry plant will be absorbed likely by a lot of other Tyson plants in the area. So, for example, Storm Lake, Waterloo, and even Columbus Junction. And those plants become even more critical to the company's production capacity, as well as to market the pork that Tyson has contracts and sales for retail, food service, and export channels that they need to fulfill. So why I highlight that is, you know, I think there's questions of, will this potentially be an indication of further closures? Well, I will flip that on its head and say I think that this gives even more significance of those other existing plants. Now, that doesn't mean it's not going to have an impact necessarily on pork producers, especially I'll look to the fourth quarter of the year. Barring any other disruptions to processing capacity, the industry will have sufficient capacity this spring and summer to process hogs. And that has as much to do with the seasonal supply of hogs, which are the smallest during the summer months, as it does the processing capacity. So we still have sufficient capacity. But as we get into the fall and winter, where seasonally we get larger supplies of hogs, that will make the capacity utilization much larger, and that could impact prices.
Before we say goodbye, Lee, comment a little bit let's zoom out to the pork industry as a whole. It's been in, you know, troubled times. You pointed that out for quite a while. The last year, the worst financial downturn in a quarter century for Iowa and the U.S. pork producers. What else is going into that, and how does the recovery look?
Well, I'll start with the bright spot actually has been export. We've seen larger export volumes in 2023 than we did in 2022. And so far, 2024 has outpaced 2023 levels as well as our expectations. Now, some of that has been exports have come at lower prices and have led to the larger volumes. You know, I think it's multifold when you look at the tough economic times. You have to point to demand being a large factor. So my estimates show retail pork demand has waned the last six quarters. So going back to third quarter of 2022. Now that's really been driven by consumer incomes. And so as you look at how inflationary pressures have impacted consumers, that has impacted pork demand and thus pork prices. Also, when you look at supplies, we've really maintained supplies of the past couple of years and actually have seen slight increases in pork production. Now, recently that's come at the form of greater efficiency in the industry. But as supplies have not decreased, that has not been supportive of prices and has actually weighed on prices. And then, as we highlighted earlier, cost of production for pork producers is up over 50% since 2020.
Quickly, Lee, you haven't mentioned this, and I spoke not too long ago with the former president of the Iowa Pork Producers Association. She pointed to the U.S. Supreme Court last year upholding California's Proposition 12 law requiring pork sold in that state to come from sows that have enough room to lie down, stand up, extend their legs, and turn around freely. Is that also impacting this whole picture?
Well, it's again impacting because of the higher cost of production. So as producers that want to maintain access to that market have had to make changes on their operations to comply with Proposition 12 regulations, those have increased the cost of production for those pork producers. And it's increased costs throughout the whole system as processors and retailers have had to make adjustments to their businesses for really tracking and handling that product, as well as those higher prices then to produce that pork has had an impact on consumers because mm-hmm. consumers now will need to pay higher prices. And so that, again, is impacting, you know, their consumer welfare.
Associate Professor and Extension Economist at ISU, Lee Schultz. Thank you for joining us, Lee.
All right. Thank you for having me.
When we come back, we'll talk about the acquitting of a protester on charges related to a protest in Iowa City last October. It's River to River from IPR News.
Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com.
This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In what's been a trend for a while, some of the largest insurance companies in the country have been ending certain coverages, excluding natural protections and raising premiums due to the increase in extreme weather caused by the changing climate. Des Moines Register investigative reporter Tyler Jett has been covering the latest developments on this front here in Iowa. Tyler, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Ben. Thanks for having me.
A farm insurance company in this latest development here, dropping some Iowa customers. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so Hastings Mutual, which is an insurance company based in Michigan, started calling some insurance agents in the last couple of weeks. I don't know exactly when because they haven't said when, but basically they began reaching out to some agents and saying, we're going to be dropping a number of your customers based off of some analysis we've done. And then they went farther than that and even began dropping the agents themselves and just saying, we're just going to drop this whole block here. I should say Hastings hasn't told us a lot about, you know, how many customers are dropping in Iowa or if there's any sort of geographic link on that. But I guess the folks I talked to here in Iowa seem to think that this is mostly in Western Iowa that the customers are getting impacted.
Okay. Western Iowa, why would that be? More extreme weather in the western half? Or just, is Hastings just more present in the western half?
I think Hastings is present in both the western and eastern half. Tom O'Meara, who is with the Independent Insurance Agents of Iowa, kind of a trade group that represents a bunch of agents, told me that basically it seems like the decision has been split down the interstate. And if you're in the western half of Iowa, you're losing your coverage. And if you're in the eastern half, you aren't. Now, the difference may be there are more farms in the western half. There also could be some weather patterns we could be seeing. I mean, maybe there's just happened to have been more hailstorms in the western half that's been costing the insurance company.
Mm-hmm. I feel like, Tyler, this is a good point for you to give us a quick primer on how insurance companies work and how they remain profitable and what Hastings has perhaps run into, along with the other insurance companies who have pulled back here in Iowa.
Sure. Well, I mean, kind of, I guess the most basic level, you know, insurance companies are charging us premiums to cover properties, our cars, our homes. For farmers, their farms. That can also extend out to the farm equipment and the barns. And of course, that can extend out to the crops themselves. And of course, they collect premiums and then they have to pay out on losses. And for people I've talked to, the goal to be running a pretty steady company is you want to have basically you want to be paying out about no more than 60 cents in claims for every $1 in premium that you're receiving.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this evidently is not working out for Hastings, but also tell us a little bit about the others, because this adds to a list of other insurance similar stories here.
Sure, yeah. So kind of jumping off what I just said, you know, for Hastings, they have been flirting with a loss ratio of over 100%, which basically means that for every dollar they're receiving in premiums, they're actually paying out more than a dollar in claims the last couple of years in Iowa, which, in other words, that is they're losing money on their insurance deals that they've been offering customers. And that does not account for all the other expenses they incur, from paying agents for writing these deals to paying their own employees to, you know, paying for overhead to operate a building, just all the things that the business needs. So if, you know, that gives you a pretty good picture of some serious financial problems that they have encountered on their Iowa policies alone. But they are not alone in Iowa and frowning on the state. There are, by my count, four other insurance companies that have pulled out of coverage in Iowa in the last year and a half or so, since October 2022. That was when the first of these five companies made a decision. And it's all very similar stories. Basically, we're losing too much money on storms in Iowa. And it is the whole Midwest has been impacted by this stuff in recent years, but Iowa has been impacted hardest from the guys I've talked to.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and they make decisions based on the advice of weather forecasters, I would assume?
So some of these companies are working with weather forecasters. I do know that an insurance agent I was talking to named Brian Neal, he's based out in Urbandale, he lost his deal with Hastings. Hastings basically said, we're not going to write any more policies with you, so you know, don't try to come to us with the customers anymore. And he told me that Hastings has informed him that they are now using a weather forecaster to make their decisions when they weren't in the past. And again, this is really the main driver on this is hailstorms and windstorms. Those have been the main things that have seen a serious increase. Pekin Insurance, which is based in Illinois, has also pulled out. They told me that they had a loss ratio above 100% for the last 5 years, even when you decount or when you stop counting the 2020 derecho, which is the most expensive storm in Iowa history. For Pekin, on that storm, they had paid $90 million out in claims, and they collected $50 million in premiums that year. So just that storm alone basically put them behind by $40 million. And they're saying, even if you don't count that, we've still been losing money.
Hmm. Yeah, and I guess one avenue for an insurance company would be to raise deductibles or to exclude certain types of events. Has that avenue, to your knowledge, been taken by any of these companies as well?
So the companies I talked to that are leaving, they're obviously not doing that. But, you know, they did say, yes, if you are a homeowner in Iowa, if you drive a car in Iowa, if you own a farm in Iowa, if you run a business in Iowa, expect your premiums to continue to increase. Also expect deductibles to begin to change, whereas in the past, maybe they would have replaced your roof with anything more than, say, $500 in damage. Maybe that's going to get bumped up to, I don't know, $2,000 or more in damage or something like that. So this becomes a lot of just basic math, and they're going to be tweaking their formulas a little bit. I mean, I know personally the insurance I've got here, which is actually through IMT, West Des Moines company, my premiums have gone up in the last couple of years by, you know, 10% or so. I also know IMT, just as a note, they put a moratorium on last year and said, we're not going to write any more new policies in Iowa, at least until this upcoming summer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and with the extreme weather in our future, for the foreseeable future, this is just the way it'll be. It's not a momentary blip, it seems, Tyler, huh?
Yeah, and this is going to be a national story. A lot of I've been told a number of national publications are looking into what's happening in Iowa specifically. One agent I talked to, or rather one insurance executive I talked to for one of these companies that has left the state, told me that they have noticed a trend where everyone for decades has known as, you know, Oklahoma, Kansas is sort of the tornado area. You know, that's the stuff everyone talks about. That's Wizard of Oz. That's Twister. Those are the famous areas. And they've said this stuff has moved over, and Iowa is kind of the new tornado alley, is what they said. So this is a problem that is not going to go away.
Okay. Tyler Jett, investigative reporter with the Des Moines Register. Thanks for the excellent coverage here and for this conversation, Tyler.
Yeah, thanks, Ben.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, a jury acquitted a protester of charges related to a protest in Iowa City. Was last October, the protest. Zachary Oren Smith was at the trial of this transgender Iowan. Joins me now. Hi, Zach.
Hi, Ben.
Take us back to that protest. I vaguely recall it in our news from a few months ago. What it was about, what happened to bring charges against Tara Dutcher, who goes by Tara McGovern.
That's right. So this was back in October of last year. This was one of many protests, right? This will sound kind of familiar, I think, to residents of Johnson County. This group, Young Americans for Freedom, brings a controversial speaker to campus. And protest ensues, right? And they've been pretty big in the past. There was one with the anti-trans activist Matt Walsh. The one in October was for Chloe Cole. It was the speaker that YAF brought in. Chloe Cole is a California activist who advocates against the access of gender-affirming care for minors. And that evening, something like 150 protesters showed up to the intersection in a line around the intersection in a big circle preventing traffic from crossing.
Mm. Okay, so you've got a big crowd, 150 people approximately, blocking traffic, and the police act. And what
yeah,
do they do?
So in what came out of this trial, right, so it took 1 month after October for charges to finally be filed. Most of what came out in initial filings was just about this kind of circle, right, this protesters who were blocking traffic. What was revealed in the trial and what the prosecutors focused primarily on was this attempt by police to create free up a single lane of traffic to get people through. Keep in mind, by the time the protesters were blocking the intersection, folks were trying to get out of the parking garage. Folks were really piling up in a line trying to get through this intersection, getting kind of contentious, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of car honking and et cetera. And so police try to clear out this lane. They try to get this going. And, protesters protesters blocked police, blocked the line, tried to keep this intersection blocked. The question became ultimately with Tara Dutcher, who goes by Tara McGovern, in their case was whether or not Dutcher McGovern was in that line.
So the charges from your reporting, blocking traffic and also interfering with official acts, you were at the trial this week. Tell us a little bit about the arguments by the prosecution and how the defense answered those charges.
That's right. So if you're following this case the way I have from the outside, you hear disorderly conduct. I've described people blocking the road. This seems like a pretty buttoned up case, right? That I don't think anybody is denying, right, that protesters had blocked traffic that evening. But the disorderly conduct, because police, as they were trying to, it wasn't until police were trying to clear that singular lane that they were really telling protesters, we need you to get out of the road. We mm-hmm. need you to make a lane. And so rather than focusing on the blocking of the larger intersection, because they were focused on that singular lane and, not everyone was in that lane, blocking that lane. It became a kind of a difficult piece for prosecution to the piece on interference with official acts. Right. It became about proximity. Tara McGovern was one of many people, right, that were, kind of shouting at police, telling them that, describing, telling them to take hands off protesters, telling them, videotaping, telling them kind of describing their rights and what they are and are not allowed to do. The question before the jury was whether or not that amounted to interference or just proximity to these official acts.
Mm-hmm. And you could observe the jury during this trial. How did you see they reacted to these arguments? So what were the high points there?
Keep in mind this is a Johnson County jury, right? Johnson County is kind of a more maybe liberal county than the next Iowan. And so, I think prosecutors went into this this trial knowing, right, that this is a Johnson County audience and they need to be very clear about what this trial is and is not about, right? In the end, this jury decided to acquit Tara McGovern of all charges. That's the disorderly conduct and interference because the evidence, which, keep in mind, in a criminal trial, prosecution is required has a pretty high standard of evidence to reach. They just didn't have the juice.
Mm-hmm. You were with Tara McGovern when they heard about the acquittal. I think we've got some tape on that. Set it up for us.
That's right. So we're waiting to hear back from the jury. It's been several hours after the sort of closing arguments from prosecutor and defense. Jury's gone to their room. We are just waiting. I'm in. We're at the dog park. We're walking around. And then as we're about to leave, Tara McGovern gets a call from their attorney.
Well, Johnson's not guilty.
Really? On both of them?
Yeah.
I'm relieved that this has ended the last 6 months of my life.
So what else did Tara McGovern say about the wider significance of her trial? Because the other protesters, seven or eight, as I recall, took the plea deal. She chose to go to trial.
Yeah. So in total, there were seven people charged in relation to that October incident. Six took plea deals. Tara McGovern was the singular protester that took that went to trial. I think an important thing to tease out here is Tara McGovern was the only person of the seven charged with aiding, charged in relation to aiding and abetting. This is for the obstructing. This is for the obstructing the street. Traffic. And that's an important thing to know, right? Because as we're talking about the difference between, right, the kind of more substantive offense, right, the being directly the person blocking a road, being the person directly interfering with police, when you're talking about aiding and abetting, trying to develop that intent argument becomes a little more tenuous and is a little harder to judge. It's a little harder for a jury to kind of latch on to, right? So for a really high standard of evidence. And so I think that's when we're talking about the wider significance, I think that's important. I think it's important to note that one of the charges that Tara McGovern received from this incident was one of the many that received increased penalties from the Iowa legislature. This is Iowa law now. I think it's important to note that a lot of people thought that maybe this acquittal was somehow challenged, maybe the precedent, maybe challenged the policy of surrounding some of these changes that were made, sort of increased penalties for protest-related charges. I've been kind of poking around at that question this week. And, the reality is no constitutional questions were raised in this trial. No substantive policy points were raised in this trial. In the end, this will have an impact on maybe for law enforcement as they're trying to charge folks in future protests. Certainly, they'll be thinking about this as they're trying to build cases against someone for blocking a street, for example. But in terms of it actually impacting kind of the validity or the kind of chargeability of some of these offenses, I mean, that's just not this case.
Zach, this trial gained national attention even. What is the wider significance here that the media is tapping into, the fact that Tara McGovern, they are trans?
Yeah. So during the trial, during Tara McGovern's testimony, they were very clear that they were not entering the road to block traffic. They were entering the road to raise visibility, to raise awareness for trans rights. Right. We're in an era where we're seeing more bills restricting or related to LGBTQ peoples in the United States now than we've seen in years. A recent Washington Post analysis of FBI data found that states that restrict LGBTQ rights are four times more likely to have hate crimes in K-12 schools between 2021 and 2022. In addition to that, the Williams Institute found that trans people are four times more likely to be the victims of violent crimes. You know, this is a community that's been particularly impacted by the kind of specter of violence, by criminality. And I think when we're thinking about the wider impacts of this case, I mean, you know, a lot of people are seeing this as a big victory for this community that the seven people all charged were trans, and you know, I think this feels like at least here in Johnson County some victory for them.
Okay, Zachary Oren Smith covering the trial of a transgender Iowan. They were acquitted of charges related to a protest in Iowa City that took place last October. Thanks, Zach.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
And we'll be back after a short break with more of your News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News.
This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including above and beyond cancer.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The month of Ramadan began this week. It's a holy month of worship for Muslims, a time of worship, studying the Quran, praying and fasting from sunrise until sunset. Let's learn more from Hassan Salim, the imam at the Islamic Center of Cedar Rapids. Hassan, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Ramadan, the most sacred month of the year for Muslims. What is Ramadan actually all about?
Well, Ramadan is about mainly a voluntary act of giving up food and water and other worldly pleasures, such as acts of intimacy throughout the day, specifically from dawn till sunset. And it's meant to show a spiritual act of devotion and dedication and worship of God. This is what the month is mainly about, but it's also a month about community, family, and solidarity with people who are experiencing hunger and thirst in all around the world, whether voluntarily or not.
Describe a typical day for a Muslim during Ramadan.
Oh, wow. A typical day is usually starting a little bit before dawn, maybe an hour or so before dawn. Families usually are up and out and about preparing what we call the suhoor. Others know as sihri, or the pre-fasting meal. It's an odd time to be having a meal, but it's required to give a fasting person the necessary nutrients and energy to be able to withstand the hunger and the thirst of the day. And once that meal is served and enjoyed, families usually pray the dawn prayer together, whether at homes or in mosques. Usually people try to frequent mosques more often than outside of the month of Ramadan, again, because it's a time of gathering and family and community. So people would go to the mosque for the dawn prayer. And then from there, they go about their days just as any other time outside of Ramadan. So if they are students or workers or parents, they would just do the regular day-to-day stuff. The only difference would be they are fasting and abstaining from food and water until sunset, and that's when the fun begins. Usually, mosques are filled with community members who gather at sunset to A, break their fast, and then B, pray together. We have a special night prayer that we usually congregate during. We call Tarawih. It's a prayer that usually lasts longer than the average five daily prayers. Lots of people who otherwise do not come to mosques usually come for this specific prayer. It has a certain feeling to it when you gather with your community members every single night to pray and to gather and unite in devotion and dedication to God. It brings people closer to the Creator, but also brings them to closer to one another. So really, the main three events in the day is the early morning meal, the sunset breaking of fast, and then the night daily prayers during Ramadan.
There are many thousands of Muslims here in Iowa. Mm-hmm. I've wondered, as a non-Muslim, Hassan, I want to acknowledge Ramadan in a greeting, for instance, if I encounter a Muslim neighbor or a member of my community. How do I do that as a non-Muslim?
Ooh, that's a good question. There are really many ways people greet one another for Ramadan. The most popular one that you might hear is Ramadan Mubarak, which is simply the Arabic for a blessed Ramadan. The reason for that being is Ramadan is received by Muslims all around the world as a month of abundance and blessings, even though it's a month in which we abstain from water, food, and other worldly pleasures. It's still somehow becomes a month of abundance. There's no one experience hunger throughout the month of Ramadan because once you break fast, communities gather. People love to feed one another through providing meals and food and charitable acts as well. And so when we say Ramadan Mubarak, what we are really saying is that Ramadan has come with abundance and blessings. And then the one I personally prefer, being an Egyptian myself, growing up in Egypt, the greeting is Ramadan Kareem, the translation of which is Ramadan is generous. And that is a way to remind one another of the importance of generosity towards others in all ways and forms. And the answer to that is usually Allahu Akram, or God is most generous. So whether you say Ramadan Mubarak or Ramadan Kareem or simply Happy Ramadan, I think it will mean a lot to a Muslim that you know.
Very good. How does Ramadan feel different this year, given the mass death, the famine, the suffering in Gaza?
It's very, very different this year. I think that Ramadan every year, while it's a month of abstaining from food and water voluntarily, and it's a month of spiritual resilience and dedication and devotion to God, and it's a month of connecting with community members, it's a month of solidarity with people in general who are experiencing hunger and thirst. Once you experience especially the first few days and first few hours even of Ramadan, once you experience the hardship of fasting, it becomes really difficult to miss the suffering of others in general, regardless where they may be and who they might be. And this year, this act of feeling the suffering of others and is intensified by witnessing and watching and observing an act of enforced hunger and thirst. We're talking about thousands, if not millions, of people who are deprived of food, clean water, long before Ramadan has begun. So they have been fasting involuntarily for now a number of months. It's definitely different. It's also different because in as we gather as communities here and elsewhere to break our fast, it's usually we break fast and there's that moment of joy once you take your first sip of water or first morsel of food after hours and hours of fasting. You experience a relief and you experience a joy, especially if you're doing so with community. This year, it's definitely hard to experience that, knowing that there are people who don't get to enjoy that moment and experience that relief and that joy. So it makes it really difficult for Muslims to fully enjoy and embrace Ramadan this year. It intensifies our feelings of solidarity and support, of course.
The thoughts of Hassan Salim, the Imam of the Islamic Center of Cedar Rapids. Thank you for your thoughts, Hassan, and Ramadan Kareem.
Thank you. Allahu Akram.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, the University of Iowa women's wrestling team finished their inaugural season, their very first season, by taking the team title at the National Collegiate Women's Wrestling Championships, and that was last weekend. Clarissa Chun joins us now, the UI Women's Wrestling head coach. Hello, Clarissa, and congratulations.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us how last weekend went.
I don't know, where do I begin? It was great. We had 15 qualify for the national championships. That's the maximum we could have. The top 10 won in each weight class, scores 15 points for the team title, 7 in the finals, 6 national champions, and 12 All-Americans out of the 15. And so it was a great weekend.
Right. And it's interesting here with crowning 6 national champions. Members of your team were competing against each other for the national title, right, in several instances?
Yeah, in 2 weight classes, at 101 and 116-pound weight class, we had the All-Iowa final, which is, you know, a great thing and a hard thing at the same time.
I bet.
You know, that's the thing. We have the 2 best in the country at multiple weight classes, I believe. And yeah, and they're so good. They're great teammates. Leave it all out on the mat, you know, friends off the mat. And it's hard to watch at times because, you know, there's always a heartache in one aspect, but a great celebration in another.
Women's collegiate wrestling is growing. For those not acquainted with it, are there differences in the rules compared to men's collegiate wrestling?
Absolutely. We wrestle international style rules, like freestyle wrestling. Completely different than men's collegiate wrestling, which they wrestle folk style, which is only wrestled in the United States. The way to score might look a little different as far as takedowns. We can score anywhere from 2 to 4 points for a takedown. And then turns, we can lock hands to turn our opponents. We can't go out of bounds. We give up a point if we go out of bounds. You can go out of bounds for the men's collegiate, not give up points for that. So the scoring system in the actual match is different, freestyle, folk style. And then the way the team like points are scored in a dual meet is different as well. So,
mm-hmm. In Division I schools, women's collegiate wrestling, who are the closest rivals to Iowa? It sounds like you dominated.
Yeah, well, we didn't necessarily dominate. It came down to the last match. North Central College in Naperville, Illinois. They're a tough program. They won nationals last year as a program. They've been around for, I think, 5 years. And then before them, McKendree University in Lebanon, Illinois, just outside of St. Louis. They won the last 3 before North Central did national titles. So between us being King University out in Tennessee, in the Tri-Cities out there, they won national title as a team in the past too. They've been around for decades.
Yeah.
Tough teams, tough programs. We've got great women across the country that are very talented and hardworking. And, you know, as the sport continues to grow, you know, the talent gets stronger and deeper. So we don't take it for granted that, you know, this national title was a hard fought one.
Clarissa Chun is the University of Iowa women's wrestling head coach. The UI women, in their inaugural season, won the team title at the National Collegiate Women's Wrestling Championships last weekend. Clarissa, congratulations again to your team, and thank you.
Oh, thank you. Go Hawks.
And that just about does it for this News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News for this 15th day of March, the Ides of March, as fans of antiquity in your life may refer to it. On this date, March 15th in 1972, did you know that The Godfather, the Francis Ford Coppola epic gangster movie with Marlon Brando, Al Pacino, premiered in New York on this date in 1972. Joining us now to groove us into the weekend, Mark Simmet of IPR Studio One. Hi, Mark.
Well, how are you doing, Ben? Do you have an offer for me I can't refuse then? Is that what you're saying?
Anyway, let's groove into the weekend. Mark Simmet, what do you got for us?
Well, we've got a couple of nice up-tempo selections to groove us into the weekend, Ben. And first is Vera Sola. Now, I'm going to admit right now that I did not know until shortly before talking to you that Vera Sola is the stage name of Danielle Aykroyd. She's the daughter of Dan Aykroyd Donna Dixon.
Wow.
Yeah, I didn't know that myself.
How interesting.
But, you know, sometimes that's not a good sign, the children of celebrities making music.
That's so true.
But in this case, she does a great job. And she's got her second album out now called Peacemaker. And this is a song titled The Line. On the clock for time, 'cause it's all just a long dark circle. Day is returned to the looping of the line. Night is only a passing thing. We'll be back again sometime.
Vera Sola, The Line with that tune. Mark, we have time for one more.
Well, next up, a band out of Switzerland. They have a fine album. It's their debut, actually. The band is called Soft Loft, and their record is called The Party and the Mess. And this is Is It Me?
Is it me or is it you? Do we keep on trying?
Is It Me by Soft Loft. Let's go out with that. Mark Simmet, thanks for those two selections. Your daily soundtrack, Mark does that with Tony Daner, his colleague, as well as CeCe Mitchell, Studio One hosts. You can tune in 7 nights a week or tune in for All Access 1 to 4 p.m. on Saturdays. Check them out. Indie rock, singer-songwriters, blues, local regional music. Mark and his colleagues have it all. Mark, take care. Have a wonderful weekend.
You too, Ben. Thanks.
I'm nothing to control. You never made me whole. Do we keep on trying? Or do we end up lying?
Today's program produced by Caitlin Troutman. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a wonderful weekend.